and Irene Curie and her husband Joliot wrote there with a fifth and a very crucial chapter in the history of the atom bomb and brought us closer to the basic building stones of our material existence. Now, why do I bore you with a recital of this chronology of genius at work? Perhaps I should tell you that there's no chemist, I suppose, who can't seek an excuse for bringing in some of his science into any discussion. He's like the president of the University of Kansas, who was traveling on the Santa Fe Railroad down through the Southwest, and one fellow all of a sudden got ill of a peculiar virus and died. They thought it was something very contagious, so they decided to better stop the train and bury him right away. And the people in the train were asked to gather around the grave, and the conductor thought, now, wait a minute, we ought to have someone say a few words over the departed brother. And so he asked someone in the audience, would someone in the group say a few words over the departed brother? Nobody responded, and finally this president of the University of Kansas got up and he said, well, if no one has anything to say, I'd like to say a few words about the University of Kansas. And so you will pardon me for this recital of the chronology of genius and science at work. I do so because it brings home more clearly than anything that I can imagine the answer to that disease of self-righteousness, indulged in so by so many people who would bottle up God and this vast universe as were the genii of old, bottled in up in some kind of professed omniscience. I believe Harry Emerson Fosdick explains it very well in some of his writings when he tells the story of a minister who went into his study and found his little daughter Anne busily sketching something on paper, and he said to her, Anne, what are you drawing? And she said, well, Daddy, I'm drawing a picture of God. But Anne, no one knows what God looks like. Well, they will when I'm through. And it's the people with the mentality of Anne, it's our fellow Americans with the mentality of Anne who make trouble for us in this world. They cannot conceive of the true vastness of the universe with its vast possibilities for development. They cannot conceive of the vastness of an ever-expanding intellect in its understanding. They cannot conceive of a social economy, of an expanding social economy, consistent with the dreams and aspirations down the long, weary ages. They cannot conceive of all of this vastness because they cannot reconcile it with their man-sized God. Thus theirs is of necessity a devotion to half-truth. Theirs is of necessity a devotion to this or that side of the truth. Theirs is of necessity a devotion to the mere husks and rhymes of good, a devotion that is the very opposite that gives energy to scientific achievement. Who are we, and what are we anyway? Among the miracles of American development, certainly in this day and time, is the integration of the American Negro minority into Western civilization. It is a miracle the like of which history has never witnessed. I do not know of any point in history where one people has been so successful in assimilating a strange culture and reaching the point of development in this country which the American Negro has reached. The American nation should be proud of that. It should be one of the laurels in their cap, of which they should speak with pride and conduct themselves with a recognition of the pride which they justifiably should have in this miracle of the ages. And yet certainly our complacent acceptance of second-class citizenship for this Negro minority does not engender confidence in the rest of the world in our moral leadership or our capacity for moral leadership. As I interpret the tenor of the present-day Negro reaction to life in America, it could well be expressed in terms like these. Let us suppose that a mystic Negro historian on the planet of Mars, a few years hence, might write of the tenor of Negro reaction in America today. Let's quote this imaginary historian on the planet of Mars. See what he would say. I tell you frankly that this is what I think he would say. I quote him. And it came to pass that for 150 years up to 1950, there had issued from America the greatest mass of idealistic verbiage ever turned loose upon civilization. It was as if a special race of mankind had been created to put into words all of the hopes and aspirations of the human race. They carved these words into stone. They wrote them onto permanent parchments for their archives. They put them to symphonic music. They dreamed them into poems. They made them into national anthems. They repeated them from the pews of their churches, Sunday after Sunday, for 150 long years from the Declaration of Independence up to 1950. The ether wafted them from their radios to countless corners of the earth. Little children learned them by rote at the cradle. All this they did, but the great world debate in the 1950s centered around the question, I'm still quoting the man from Mars, centered around the question as to whether those American people had ever carved the substance of these words into their hearts. Whether they had really seared the essence of these words into their soul. And men all over the world began to ask each other this question. And the peoples of the earth, particularly the millions of people of color, began to study these words against their immense background of curious paradoxes. For a peculiar darkness of spirit had descended upon the world like a blanket of ugly fog. A spirit of skepticism, I'm still quoting the man from Mars, born in the religious cynicism of Soviet Russia and punctuated by the awful realism of atomic weapons. And children of fearful hearts wondered the world over if they could really believe in the words and phrases that had come to them from America. And men wrote of such things as the American dilemma, strange fruit, and killers of the dream. Indeed, some men seeking understanding finally went back to the dawn of this era of verbiage. For as a child begins, so shall its life be mirrored. And there they found a possible answer, they thought. The skeptics and the cynicists found what they thought was a possible answer. For in the 18th century assembly room in Virginia, where Thomas Jefferson and James Madison are debating the newly born and since heralded American Bill of Rights, I'm still quoting the man from Mars, men listened to the words from Jefferson. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty. But at this point, the listener is confused and hears no more. For outside the room, the thundering crack of a whip is heard, and following it, the pitiful moan of a poor black slave. And cynics the world over thought they understood America better as a result of this bit of history. I'm still quoting the man from Mars. And some men of stout hearts walked into the ghettos upon this strange land. And it so happened that these men had seen many ghettos in their time. They had walked through Vienna's Leopoldstadt, where Jews had been made into Jews, but not into Viennese. They had seen the dens of Warsaw and Lublin. But here were ghettos which surpassed all human understanding, or the wildest conjuring of human imagination in this strange land, America. And in these ghettos, men saw black children beginning their day of learning in school, standing at rapt attention, eyes riveted upon a flag, and singing with their mouths, "The Star-Spangled Banner, O long may it wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." And these men saw that while many were brave in this strange land of plenty, only some were free. I'm still quoting the man from Mars. And it further came to pass that one day in one of these strange ghettos, a brown boy stood up and softly murmured to his fellow prisoners, Yet do I marvel at this curious thing, to make a poet black and bid him sing. Yet do I marvel at this curious thing, to make a poet black and bid him sing. For this boy was a poet whom a gracious god of destiny did bid sing. And one day he sang a simple childhood song. Once riding in old Baltimore, head filled, heart filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger, and so I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December, but of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. And it was strange how this very simple and trite little song from this boy went to foreign lands, and people all over the world began to read it and to understand the deep pathos and the poignant meaning of this childhood song. And men took this song of Count Cullen's to all corners of the globe and to all languages, and people shook their heads in wonder. And even one day in the dawn of Hitler's Germany, I was shocked to be at a Kulturbund meeting and to find a young German stand up and give this song to the audience. Ich fuhr einmal nach Baltimore, oken abend glick und mein Licht. Ein weißer Junge neben mir, der sah mir ins Gesicht. 8 Jahre waren beide wir. Ich ohne Argwohn lag ihm zu. Da streckt seine Zunge aus, du schwarzer Nigger, du. Ich habe Baltimore gesehen, von Fliederblühen zum Flockenschneien. Von allem, was auch sonst geschehen, fällt stets nur dies mir ein. And men who heard this song came from all parts of the world. It was translated into all languages. Men came to Washington thinking that Washington was a symbol of our national character. But they didn't find it so. And a man from faraway Denmark went back and wrote to Washington. In great humility, I believe you should know that Washington today, despite its great outward beauty, is not a good salesman for your kind of democracy. For they found in Washington 1/3 of its population of color degraded to third-class citizenship. And the news traveled far and wide. I'm still quoting the man from Mars. While the monster was falling upon Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the news traveled. While Soviet Russia began to manufacture these monsters from the pitch blend of mountainous Czechoslovakia, the news traveled. And while the whole world began to tremble with fear, the news traveled far and wide, conveying something of the truth of a black man's life in America. And Russia saw to it that the news reached all corners of the globe. And people from this strange country, America, went by airplanes to all corners of the earth and wondered why people just didn't believe what they told them. And still they couldn't understand just why these people, many of them colored people, didn't embrace their type of democracy with open arms. And they laid it all at the door of Russia. And it came to pass that this great country gradually lost its effectiveness as a world leader in ideals, and despair settled over the entire world like a blanket of ugly fog, for the last best hope of earth had been dashed. End quote. From the man from Mars. Need it be that way?